Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Bill Head. This is being recorded on Wednesday, January 28th, 2026. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Immigration crackdown in Minneapolis. Report. Two officers fired shots. Colorado census. State's growth slowest since 90. Lakewood. Council sends zoning codes to voters amid pushback. Colorado Supreme Court. Aurora asks for clarity on ruling about sentencing. At the top of the Denver Post are three banners. The upper left-hand corner is a green banner with the featuring a picture of the TikTok symbol. Caption, YouTube, social media firm settles in trial over addiction. Middle banner is a blue banner featuring a photograph of Denver Broncos coach Sean Payton. The play, not the decision, is what brings head coach. Third banner is purple, featuring a photograph of a bowl of food. Food, these seven easy recipes show tofu isn't boring. Read more, sign up for email newsletters at myaccount.denverpost.com. Today's weather, high of 52, low of 28. Upper right-hand corner is an ad for Barat's Dental. Free consult with CT scan, 720-259-9959. Also on the Denver Post is a photograph of two people dancing, commemorating liberation. Photograph by R.J. Sangosti, the Denver Post. Immigration crackdown in Minneapolis. Report, two officers fired shots. Congress notified of findings. Ecuador files protest over agents trying to enter consulate, featuring a photograph of two federal police officers. Caption, federal agents make a traffic stop on a U.S. citizen as they provide their identification, including a passport and a driver's license, Tuesday in Minneapolis. Photograph by Adam Gray, the Associated Press. Article by Seung Min Kim, Mike Catalini, and Steve Karnosky, the Associated Press, Washington. Two federal officers fired shots during the encounter that killed ICU nurse Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, a Customs and Border Protection official told Congress in a notice sent Tuesday. Officers tried to take Preddy into custody and he resisted, leading to a struggle, according to a notification to Congress obtained by the Associated Press. During the struggle, a Border Patrol agent yelled, "He's got a gun," multiple times, the official said. A Border Patrol officer and a CBP officer each fired Glock pistols, the notice said. Investigators from CBP's Office of Professional Responsibility conducted the analysis based on a review of body-worn camera footage and agency documentation, the notice said. The law requires the agency to inform relevant congressional committees about deaths in CBP custody within 72 hours. The notification came a day after President Donald Trump ordered Border Czar Tom Homan to take over his administration's immigration crackdown in Minnesota following Preddy's death, which was the second fatal shooting this month of a person at the hands of immigration law enforcement. Ecuador's Minister of Foreign Affairs, meanwhile, filed a protest with the U.S. Embassy after Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents tried to enter the Ecuadorian consulate in Minneapolis without permission Tuesday. A video of the attempt on social media shows a consulate staffer running to the door to turn the ICE agents away, telling them, "This is the Ecuadorian consulate. You're not allowed to enter." One ICE officer can be heard responding by threatening to grab the staffer if he touched the agent before agreeing to leave. International law generally prohibits law enforcement authorities from entering foreign consulates or embassies without permission, though sometimes permission may be assumed granted for life-threatening emergencies. Consulate officials immediately prevented the ICE officer from entering the consular building, thus ensuring the protection of the Ecuadorians who were present at the time and activating the emergency protocols issued by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Human Mobility, the ministry wrote on X. A note of protest was filed with the U.S. Embassy in Ecuador so that similar attempts aren't made at other consulates, the ministry said. The State Department, Homeland Security, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not immediately respond to requests for comment. By sending Homan to Minnesota, we're going to de-escalate a little bit, Trump said during an interview on Fox News' Will Cain show. That's significant since White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, when questioned repeatedly Monday about Homan's being dispatched to Minnesota, refused to say that doing so was in an effort to calm the situation. The president added of Homan, Tom, as tough as he is, gets along with governors and mayors, even in Democratic areas. As he left the White House on Tuesday, the president was asked whether Alex Preti's killing on Saturday was justified. He responded by saying that a big investigation was underway. In the hours after Preti's death, some administration officials sought to blame the shooting on the 37-year-old intensive care nurse. Trump said in an interview broadcast Tuesday that he had great calls with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey on Monday, mirroring comments he made immediately after the calls. The seemingly softer tone emerged as immigration agents were still active across the Twin Cities region. Separately, a man was arrested after he sprayed an unknown liquid at U.S. Rep. Ilhan Omar while she was speaking at a town hall meeting in Minneapolis. Colorado census, state's growth slowest since 90. Last year, immigration slowed dramatically. Colorado could see a smaller gain this year. Featuring a photograph of a residential area in Denver, the state's population rose from 5,988,502 to 6,012,561. Colorado remains the 20th most populous state. Photograph by Hyung Chang, Denver Post File. Article by Aldo Svaldi. Colorado's population rose by 24,059 people last year, the weakest increase measured since 1990, according to an update Tuesday from the U.S. Census Bureau. The gain, however, was enough to push the state's population above 6 million for the first time. 35 years ago, Colorado was among a handful of oil and gas states experiencing a severe recession because of low energy prices, and from 1986 to 1990, more people left the state to pursue better opportunities elsewhere than moved in. The state economy is chugging along this time around, not great, but not horrible. Yet, it appears high housing costs and slower job growth may be exerting a strong outward push. Last year, the state saw a weakening in its strongest contributor to population growth since the pandemic, immigration. Nationally, President Donald Trump's push to curb immigration a year ago lowered the country's population growth rate from 1% in 2024 to 0.5% in 2025. Colorado's decrease was even larger, going from 1.9% growth rate to a 0.4%, a two-thirds decline. The U.S. Census Bureau measures changes in population from July to June 30th every year in what is called a vintage. The strictest immigration policies were in place for only half that period, but they were enough to help push net immigration from 2.8 million people in the prior period to 1.3 million. If that trend continues, the annual gain from net immigration in the next count, mid-2026, could drop to only 321,000 people, the U.S. Census Bureau estimates. Colorado's gain includes 20,608 from natural increases or births minus deaths. Net migration contributed 3,256 residents with net immigration of 15,356, offsetting a net decline of 12,100 from domestic migration. The country had an estimated population of nearly 342 million compared to 340 million in the 2024 count. The state's population rose from 5,988,502 to 6,012,561. Colorado remains the 20th most populous state behind Maryland and ahead of Wisconsin. The downward shift was more pronounced in other states. California went from a gain of 232,000 residents in 2024 to a loss of 9,500 people in 2025 due primarily to reduced immigration. Hawaii, New Mexico, Vermont, and West Virginia also lost population. New York added only 1,008 people after a drop in immigration from 207,000 to 95,600. Florida saw its domestic migration drop by nearly two-thirds and immigration drop by more than half, but it still had one of the largest overall gains along with Texas and North Carolina. South Carolina, Idaho, and North Carolina had the highest year-over-year population growth rates, ranging from 1.3% to 1.5%. Many of these states are going to show even smaller growth when we get to next year. Brookings demographer William Frey predicted Tuesday. In 1990, the state added 18,840 residents, but the population is now 80% larger, so the comparison isn't an even one. Although the pandemic slowed growth, last time the rate of population growth was so low was in 1989. Only half done, this decade is shaping up to be the slowest the state has seen for growth since the 1980s. Since 2020, Colorado has seen a net of 17,729 people arrive from other U.S. states. By contrast, net immigration, people arriving from other countries, surged by 130,218. Net migration, which historically is 80% domestic and 20% international, has flipped the other way and then some. Little on the horizon suggests that slower population growth rates will reverse itself, especially with fewer immigrants and now more outflows than inflows domestically. Demographic winter, long predicted, could be arriving earlier than expected. One of the plus sides demographically, births rose 4.6% to 65,380 from 2023 to 2024 period, and are now at the highest pace since 2017. Deaths remain fairly flat, raising by 59 or 0.1% from the prior period. That said, the holiday that death can take is limited, given the state's aging population. The state demography office had a forecast a population gain of 33,154 and net migration of 13,568 for 2025. It was off by nearly 10,000 due almost entirely to weaker net migration. Last year, if it had cut population forecasts through 2029 by 120,000 residents, and it may need to make more revisions, especially if immigration dries up even more. What caused domestic migration to turn negative, given the absence of a recession? When someone arrives in a state from another country, they are counted as an international migrant. But if they move to another state, they are counted as a domestic migrant, according to the state demography office. A lot of international arrivals to Colorado between 2022 and 2025 came on humanitarian grounds and were likely headed elsewhere. And the Census Bureau, which makes no distinction between legal and illegal immigration, has gotten better at counting those arriving as refugees or under the protected status than in the past. At least some portion of the domestic out-migration from Colorado is made up of recently arrived international migrants, the state demography office said in a release discussing the census members. That means a drop in migration could translate into better numbers on domestic migration in the next estimate. But an annual survey from the United from United Van Lines, whose customers tend to be older and higher income households, reported that Colorado last year had become a strong outbound state, one of only five for the first time since 1990. For much of the 2010s, Colorado was a strong inbound state before becoming more balanced after the pandemic. That would suggest that it isn't only the newest residents who departed, but also more established and wealthier households who were picking up and leaving. Slower growth should allow the state to catch up on its housing shortfall, and if population gains are weak enough, reduced demand could even push rents and home prices lower. Apartment rents in Denver are already back to 2022 levels. Governments could catch up on much-needed infrastructure, but their budgets may also take a hit given that population growth, along with inflation, determines how much additional spending they are allowed each year. Broomfield economist Gary Horvath said, slower population gains and slower job gains tend to correlate with each other. Normally, a lack of job opportunities results in slower population growth, but he suggests the situation might be reversed. With the exception of healthcare in 2025, there was weak job growth in many sectors. If a person is needed to fill a job and we don't have that person, the labor market will struggle. Not from a lack of demand, but from a lack of supply, he said. The Associated Press contributed to this report. Colorado Supreme Court. Aurora asks for clarity on ruling about sentencing. Justices said municipal court punishments can't exceed state allowances. By Sam Tabachnik. Aurora leaders want the Colorado Supreme Court to clarify its recent ruling on municipal court sentences, saying they're concerned the decision could have broader implications on the rights of local governments to make decisions on matters of local concern. The state's high court in December ruled unanimously that cities cannot punish lawbreakers beyond what state courts would allow for the same offense. The decision set a precedent for municipal courts around the state, forcing city councils to alter their ordinances, judges to change their advisements to defendants, and shifting the landscape of plea agreements between defense attorneys and city prosecutors. Aurora officials on Monday filed a petition for a rehearing with the state Supreme Court, saying they don't contest the ruling but remain concerned about the potential breadth of the decision beyond the facts of the case itself. In the petition, the city asked the court to provide clarity on how far the ruling's legal precedent extends. To be clear, Aurora is not asking the court to change its ultimate holding in the case, Aurora City Attorney Pete Schulte said in a statement Tuesday. The city is committed to following the holding and will not sentence any individuals beyond what is allowed under state law for comparable state offenses. Aurora is only asking the court to consider providing more clarity and guidance to cities on its effort on other areas of Colorado law. Schulte has been a vocal critic of the Supreme Court's decision. In a statement after the ruling, he questioned whether Colorado municipalities should continue to prosecute criminal offenses when they become de facto extensions of state and county courts at a cost to municipal taxpayers without reimbursement. The city attorney told Aurora lawmakers earlier this month that the ruling had raised concerns about how a variety of existing city laws might be affected, including zoning, land use, and other regulations unrelated to criminal penalties, the Sentinel newspaper in Aurora reported Tuesday. The Supreme Court ruling centered on two cases involving low-level prosecutions in Westminster and Aurora municipal courts, in which the alleged offenders faced significantly more jail time after being charged in city court than they would have if they had been charged in state court. Westminster officials did not respond Tuesday when asked whether the city plans to file a similar petition. The December ruling came on the heels of the Denver Post reporting last year that found municipal courts had become the state's most punitive forum for minor crimes. In 2021, on the heels of nationwide protests for racial justice, Colorado lawmakers enacted sweeping state-level reforms that significantly lowered the potential penalties for misdemeanor and petty offenses in Colorado state courts. But those reforms didn't impact municipal courts, which are not part of the state judicial system. As a result, the potential jail sentences for minor crimes in city courts now often far outpaces the state's limit, the Post reported last year. The newspaper found defendants across 10 of Colorado's largest cities served, on average, 5 times more jail time in municipal court cases, though the difference was just a matter of days. Cities across the state are changing procedures and ordinances to come into compliance with December's ruling. The Denver City Council said it hoped to have updated language by the end of the month, while the city of Littleton passed an emergency ordinance prohibiting city judges from punishing people beyond what state statute would allow for the same offense. Lakewood. Council sends zoning codes to voters amid pushback. Controversial measures go to an April 7th election after successful petition. Featuring a photograph of a home under construction with the caption, "A home is pictured under construction at 6400 West Exposition Avenue in Lakewood on September 26th. Photographed by Hyung Chang, The Denver Post. Article by John Aguilar. Lakewood residents will get a chance to vote on a series of controversial zoning code changes passed by the city's elected leaders last year after a group of residents mounted an effort to challenge the new rules. The city council decided early Tuesday morning to send its zoning updates, which are intended to spur greater density and the building of more affordable homes in the city of 156,000, to an April 7 special election. This is a consequential issue for the city of Lakewood. I think we all agree on that, and I hope that everyone will get out and vote," Councilman Roger Lowe said at the end of the Monday night meeting that stretched more than 5 hours and ended after midnight. Earlier in the meeting, the council approved a supplemental budget appropriation of $42 million to refund dozens of telecommunications companies for years of improperly collected business and occupation taxes. Last September, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that the tax had been imposed in violation of the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, which requires any new tax in Colorado to first get voter approval in an election. The $42,154,189 the city must return to 177 companies represents more than 13% of the city's 2026 budget. On the zoning matter, the council passed 4 ordinances in the last half of 2025 that together encouraged the construction of more varied housing types and, by extension, greater density, with the ultimate aim of lowering home prices in a notoriously expensive metro housing market. The measures allow diverse housing types, like duplexes and townhomes, anywhere in the city. They also limit new home sizes to 5,000 square feet and urge the conversion of vacant or underused commercial buildings to housing. The new rules went into effect January 1st. But opponents of the rezoning effort collected more than 10,000 signatures last fall to place 4 measures on a proposed March 31st special election ballot, changed to April 7th by the council, that will give voters the final say. The successful petition left the council with the choice of either repealing the ordinances or sending the matter to a special election. Opponents say the city's zoning changes will endanger the character of older neighborhoods and won't actually help reduce home prices. These zoning ordinances are not good for Lakewood because they reduce transparency and have development decisions occur behind closed doors, said rezoning opponent Kathy Kentner, a former Lakewood mayoral candidate who has long fought density efforts in the city. "These ordinances would encourage overdevelopment at the cost of our natural environment with no guarantee of affordability that we are all looking for." In a news release issued last week, fellow opponent and lifelong Lakewood resident Regina Hopkins called the city's rezoning efforts a blue, a blueprint for crammed, profit-driven development, bulldozed trees, and ignored infrastructure. Developers do not build for affordability. They build for profit, she said. The resistance in Lakewood echoes what occurred in nearby Littleton last November where voters approved a charter amendment that will make it more difficult to build anything but single-family homes in a large chunk of the city. Supporters of Lakewood's redrafted zoning regulations say the status quo is simply not working. Young families, they say, are finding it increasingly impossible to find a reasonably priced starter home. There's nothing about the new zoning code that allows for the bulldozing of neighborhoods. It's completely disinformation, Lakewood resident Shane Sarnak said during public comment Monday night. The median price of a detached home sold last year in Metro Denver was $650,000, up 0.39% from 2024 and also from 2022, when the median price was $647,500. Median condo and townhome prices look more fatigued, falling 2.85% from 2024 to $391,900 in 2025. A collection of bills passed by state lawmakers in 2024 was designed to increase higher density living and bring home prices down. Those measures were quickly challenged by several Front Range municipalities in court, with the plaintiffs claiming the legislature and Governor Jared Polis were encroaching on their home rule powers to set land use rules. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Maxine Artist Fulton, August 17, 1934 to January 8, 2026. Bomar died at home January 8, 2026 at the age of 91. Margaret Peggy Hollinger, July 8, 1932 to January 20, 2026. Funeral services Friday, January 30th, Mass 11 a.m., St. Thomas More, 8035 South Quebec Street, Centennial, 80112. Robert Joseph Sarconi, January 4, 1937 to January 19, 2026. Robert Bob Joseph Sarconi, 89 of Arvada, Colorado, passed away peacefully on January 19, 2026. Now I'll be reading an article from the Denver Post Culture section. Recognition, Denver Sandwich, one of the best in North America, featuring a photograph of Chef Jose Avila's Pambasa de Carnitas sandwiches were just named one of the six best sandwiches by Michelin in North America. Photographed by R.J. Sangasti, the Denver Post. Article by Miguel Otarola. Late last year, the critics behind Michelin's food and travel guides published a list of what they deemed to be the six of the best sandwiches in North America, including one in Denver. Chef Jose Avila has served the Pambasa de Carnitas, the bread slathered and marinated in red guajillo chili sauce, for 6 years, first from his food truck and since 2021 at his flagship Denver restaurant, La Diabla Pozole y Mezcal. This sandwich is excellent, the exterior lightly crispy, with the distinct toasty flavor of the chili, and the carnitas inside are tender, juicy, and flavorful, enhanced by savory brown bits, Michelin's anonymous inspector wrote. It's flavorful, displays good technique, and uses quality ingredients. Avila, who found out about the Michelin honor through Instagram, is using the opportunity to shed light on Pambosas and their humble origin. The Pambazo doesn't get close to anything that you could probably relate to, Avila said from his kitchen, having just prepared the Campechano version on the menu, filled not with carnitas but with chorizo and cecina, a thinly sliced cured beef. But when someone orders it, he continued, pretending to be a hungry customer, his eyes darting to the sandwich he had just finished, plating with small baked potatoes and cheese-stuffed jalapeno. What is that? I want one of those. Structurally, the pambazo is similar to a torta, but the former's origins are more closely tied to Mexico City, its prominent food vendors, and Mexican Independence Day celebrations, Avila said. You can see these stands with all these mountains of bread already being marinated, Avila said. The marinated bread is fried, then piled with meat, cheese, lettuce, beans, and other toppings. The name pambazo comes from pambaxo, the roots of which refer to lower quality bread, according to Mexican anthropologist Virginia Garcia Acosta, who researched the bread's origins. Unlike the shorter and wider traditional pambazos, avíos are narrower and 13 inches long, large enough to call an entree. Because he couldn't find a specific roll he wanted, his team started baking its own. At La Diabla, 2233 Larimer Street, the bread is fried in pork fat and spends about 5 minutes on the griddle with the other elements of the sandwich, including the meat and onions. Once off the heat, Avila spreads salsa verde and salsa negra on top of the bread and slices one whole avocado to layer on top of the meat. The sandwich is listed online at $18. For $3 extra, Avila envelops the entire thing in cheese crust or costra. The Michelin list shows the sandwich paired with a beef marrow bone, which is another addition. Avila credited his mother, Angelina Avila, with giving him the idea to first sell pambazas at his food truck, Ex Tabay Yuca Teco. It's been a sleeper ever since, he said. Then he raised his eyebrows and looked out toward the dining room. He sold 500 pambazas a week at La Diabla before the recommendations by Michelin. Now it's double that, he said. Trends. Dirty sodas are popping up on Denver menus. Featuring a photograph of an orange dreamsicle dirty soda at Snooze, provided by Snooze. Article by Brittany Anas, special to the Denver Post. When the culinary team at Denver-based breakfast chain Snooze was brainstorming new menu items, it quietly slipped dirty sodas onto a secret menu. Dirty sodas, secret menu sounds a little salacious. Yes, in reality, these non-alcoholic sippers are perfectly PG, classic sodas remixed with creams and flavored syrups. But they did recently spill over to Colorado menus and elsewhere around the country from Utah after being the beverage of choice on The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, a scandalous reality show that follows TikTok mom influencers in Utah. We don't drink alcohol or do drugs, and so it's a kind of service, said one of the Mormon wives, Demi Ingeman, in a confessional during the show's first season, which aired in 2024. The women have frequently shared their custom dirty soda orders and helped catapult the once niche drink, often guzzled from 44-ounce mega cups, into the spotlight. The series also features B-roll of Swig, the fast-growing Utah-based chain widely credited as the originator of the dirty soda, cementing the beverage's pop culture moment. Industry insiders say you can expect to see these sugar-spun dirty sodas popping up everywhere in 2026 and beyond. They're an easy win for restaurants, coffee shops, and fast food chains because they allow owners to leverage ingredients they already have behind the bar or barista counter. Dirty sodas are simple to execute, highly customizable, and very profitable, said Jonathan Toffel, founder and CEO of Mission Field, a Denver-based global CPG, consumer packaged goods, innovation, insights, and strategy consultancy. They give guests something playful without adding complexity to the kitchen. That's certainly the case at Snooze, which creates more of a scratch-made dirty soda, building its strawberry shortcake dirty soda with Sprite, vanilla syrup, and house-made strawberry puree, normally destined for pancakes, but moonlighting here in beverage form, plus a splash of vanilla cream that's also used in French toast. Other $3.95 dirty sodas include a pineapple upside-down inspired version and a creamy, fizzy, Fanta-based orange dreamsicle. Never had a dirty soda before? It's like a cream soda when you mix it up, explained Jordan Russell, senior brand manager at Snooze. Where to find dirty sodas in the Denver area? Cookie and soda shop Twisted Sugar's pitch to franchise owners leans on both habit and indulgence. The average American drinks a whopping 38 gallons of soft drinks a year, yet still craves new flavors, according to the company. Its market research also points to a thriving sweet treat culture, showing that 70% of consumers buy desserts at least once a week as a form of self-reward. At the soda shop's Highland Ranch Post, 3624 East Highland Ranch Parkway, that appeal is on full display. On a recent weekday afternoon, the store was bustling with high schoolers. A wall of service beckoned soda lovers to create their own combinations, but I opted for pre-imagined menu favorite, peaches and cream, made with Sprite, peach puree, and cream. Flavor add-ins, though, range from coconut to green apple, kiwi, lavender, passion fruit, vanilla, and more. At Punch Bowl Social, 65 Broadway, Denver, an eatertainment spot, dirty sodas have earned a permanent spot on the menu, including a dirty cherry cola, $7, with cold foam and a black cherry syrup or an alcoholic version with Jack Daniels for $12. The $12 Pineapple Express is made with tequila, Jarritos pineapple soda, pineapple, lime, and strawberry. The team at Ziggy's Coffee, which has several locations in the Denver metro area, said it originally tested dirty sodas in select markets and the drinks quickly became a guest favorite. So the shop added them as permanent menu items in June 2025. Ziggy's dirty sodas start with familiar soda bases like Dr. Pepper, Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Starry, and Mug Root Beer, then get dirtied up with flavor infusions, fruit purees, creamy finishes, and toppings like boba, fruit, or whipped cream. The lineup ranges from fan favorites like Ridin' Dirty, Dr. Pepper, a splash of vanilla and coconut cream twist, and Neon Wave, Mountain Dew with blue raspberry, coconut, and raspberry cold foam, to seasonal drinks. The coffee shop features 20 signature combinations, plus many more ways to customize your own drink. Look a little closer, though, and the dirty soda concept isn't entirely new. Soda drinkers have been experimenting with mashups for decades. Ever since fast food restaurants moved soda machines out from behind the counter and gave customers free rein to mix their own drinks, Toefel said. Coke and root beer mix, he said, orange soda and Mountain Dew, dirty sodas took this type of natural experimentation up another level. How Mormon wives created a drink trend. Many Mormons follow a health code known as the Word of Wisdom, which discourages alcohol, coffee, and tea. Soda, however, long occupied a gray area, but in 2012, the church clarified that caffeinated sodas were indeed acceptable, according to an episode on NPR's All Things Considered. Around this time, the market was wide open for indulgent, customizable, non-alcoholic drinks, said Ben Tannenbaum, a beverage industry analyst, whose newsletter Proof Points tracks industry trends. Drive-through soda shops like Swig and Sodalicious became the local Starbucks equivalent. Social gathering spots built around fountain sodas jazzed up with flavored syrups and cream, he said. Swig opened up its first shop in St. George, Utah in 2010 and has since grown to more than 120 locations around the United States. There are none in Colorado, though. Secret Lives of Mormon Wives was a cultural accelerant, Tannenbaum points out. After the show premiered in September 2024, Yelp saw more than a 600% increase in Dirty Soda's searches from the prior year. It did what reality TV does best and made regional culture feel accessible and aspirational to a national audience, he said. Suddenly, Dirty Sodas weren't just a Utah quirk, they were a lifestyle product. And corporations took notice. Once you have those search numbers, chains move fast, Tannenbaum said. Taco Bell experimented with a dirty Baja Blast. Jack in the Box has Twisted Soda, and Sonic got in the game too. Coffee Mate even released retail dirty soda creamers so people can DIY at home. Now I'm waiting for the first dirty soda with alcohol brand to launch, Tannenbaum said. It's only a matter of time. Brittany Annis is a Denver-based freelance writer. I'll be reading from the Denver Post sports section. Broncos, Peyton, Nick's ankle condition may break inevitable. Featuring a photograph of Broncos quarterback Bo Nix running with the football. Bo Nix of the Broncos scrambles for a gain as Joey Bosa of the Bills chases him during the fourth quarter of the Broncos' 33-30 overtime win in Denver on January 17th. Photograph by Aaron Antiveros, the Denver Post. Article by Parker Gabriel. Sean Payton came across a strange sight in the Broncos facility Tuesday morning. His quarterback, Bo Nix, with a newly surgically repaired right ankle, was cruising around on a medical scooter. He was just up above us here, the Denver head coach said of Nix from the front atrium of the Denver's facility, pointing up to the second floor windows. I said, "What are you doing? Getting your scooter laps in?" Peyton and general manager George Patton provided the fullest accounting yet of Nix's injury, a pre-existing issue that made the fracture a matter of when, according to Peyton, and an expectation he'll be back to work in May. What was found was a condition that was predisposed. They always find a little more when they go in, Peyton told reporters Tuesday, a week after Nix had surgery performed by Dr. Norman Waldrop III in Birmingham, Alabama. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. When you look at the play and you're trying to evaluate it, the operating surgeon said that this was going to happen sooner than later. Now you go about the rehab, proper orthotics, all those things. Peyton said Nix, for the next several weeks, will work through stages of graduating from scooter to crutches and then eventually to a walking boot. Peyton said Nix is currently tracking toward a return sometime in May, which is the month in which the Broncos will hold organized team activities and aligns with the 12 to 16-week timeline reported last week. For now, Nix is scooting around the team facility. You have to know him. He's fidgety to begin with, Peyton said. He might have just been getting his scooter laps. He was up there like in an area he'd never been in the department-wise. He's handling it like a pro. Man, I'm sure if there's disappointment for him to have to watch. It's difficult to get as far as he brought us and then also see one of his contemporaries, someone in his draft class, who he would have loved to have competed against, advance. It's a tough deal. That, of course, is Nix's pre-draft training partner and New England quarterback Drake May. Nix has been one of those players that I would say has been available, Peyton said. There were others in that draft class that weren't as available. I think the rehab coming off this was strong. The news and the way it was explained was it was coming sooner rather than later. He'll rehab his tail off and get back to being healthy. Now I'll be reading an editorial from the Denver Post. Racial profiling. My parents thought we had made it. Now we carry papers. By Laura Wynn, the Minnesota Star Tribune, TNS, Minneapolis. In recent weeks, my 80-year-old Asian-American parents have started to carry their passports each time they leave their suburban townhouse. Neighbors on their Ring doorbell app will alert users when ICE agents are spotted on nearby roads. My mom has canceled appointments after receiving such warnings. A practical woman, she says she's in a game of cat and mouse with federal agents, and she'll be damned if she gives them the upper hand. This is something the headlines often miss when describing what it's like to be living with ICE in Minnesota. We know that federal agents shot and killed Renee Good and Alex Preddy. We've learned that agents have approached and detained residents who appear to be foreign at grocery stores and bus stops. We've seen the picture of a 5-year-old Liam with his Spider-Man backpack and animal show hat before he and his dad were taken by federal agents. We've watched the horrific videos of masked agents tackling, cuffing, and dragging U.S. citizens through the street, or parading them into Arctic chills in their boxers and later releasing them without apology. On Saturday morning, Preddy, an ICU nurse, was killed by a Border Patrol agent while holding his phone to record a chaotic scene. It shouldn't be forgotten that Preddy lost his life on Eat Street, a corridor revived by immigrants. Believe the video that shows Preddy was a helper. He was helping a woman whom an agent violently shoved to the ground. He was helping document the actions by federal agents so that truth could be preserved. Maybe Preddy knew how difficult life was becoming for those around him. A quiet, pervasive fear that has taken root in the Twin Cities, forcing some people of color who are not even immigrants to change our behaviors. We take extra precautions. We carry the passport and we question our belonging. Federal agents have been recorded on video acknowledging that they're homing in on individuals who speak with foreign agents or foreign accents. In one encounter, a man named Ramon Manera had just returned home to Columbia Heights with his daughter after getting ice cream when he was approached by a Border Patrol agent. "Now, talking to you, hear that you have an accent, I have reason to believe you're not born of this country," the agent says in the video. Another video shot at my local Costco parking lot, agents are seen politely asking random shoppers unloading their carts if they are U.S. citizens. These interactions with agents are almost as chilling as footage of their violent tactics. Such videos normalize unabashed racial profiling by our federal government. "Somali Americans in Minnesota," says Trump, "should go back to where they came from," a slur that so many kids from immigrant families have heard. Only now it is repeated by children who cite the leader of the free world. What troubles me is how far we are regressing. Asian Americans, in particular, have always struggled with being perceived as perpetual outsiders no matter how long we've lived in the country. When immigrants of my parents' generation started families here in the 1970s, many of them figured their children would fit in and thrive here, so long as they gave their children Western names and made sure they could speak perfect American English. I always felt they went overboard, that we didn't have to whitewash ourselves to gain acceptance. A half century later, I'm thinking maybe my parents were onto something. In the initial weeks of the ICE surge in Minnesota, I refused to carry my passport, an act of defiance in a country I no longer recognize. I worried more about my mom, who has a master's degree in English but speaks with a Taiwanese accent, and my dad, an Army veteran who grew up in the Midwest but has Alzheimer's and struggles with his words. But the other night, after hearing from Twin Cities police chiefs that their officers of color are federal agents demanding paperwork, I uploaded my passport to my Apple wallet just to be safe. I felt like a compromise I could live with. A document that once made me proud of all the places I've traveled is now a badge to prove I belong. It speaks volumes that a person like me is scared. Somebody with so many privileges, including my perfect American English. Aren't you scared, too? Lauren Nguyen writes opinions and reported pieces exploring parenting, gender, family, and relationships with special attention on women and underrepresented communities. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Bill Head.
Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Sun, read by Liz. This is being recorded on Friday, January 30th, 2026. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. State regulators get an earful on Xcel energy shutdowns from Coloradans left without electricity for days. Tri-State says no thanks to federal orders to keep Craig Coal Power Plant open. And Colorado answers Trump administration's demand for information about wolf reintroduction, pushes back on malfeasance accusations. And then we'll be following up with a few miscellaneous articles. In energy news, state regulators get an earful on Xcel power shutdowns from Coloradans left without electricity for days. State utilities regulators collected testimony from 4,000 businesses, households with life-saving medical equipment, and the merely annoyed as they form rules for public safety power shutoffs, by Mark Jaffe. There's a photograph at the beginning of this article showing the sky and power poles with men in truck lifts working on the lines. And the caption reads, Xcel energy workers toil to repair power lines on a street closed after hurricane-force winds whipped through the metropolitan area and interrupted service for residents, Thursday, December 18th, 2025, in Denver. In December, Rainbow Schultz was preparing for Xcel Energy's announced shutdown of power lines to cope with the high winds, since her restaurant, the Jamestown Mercantile, had lost $8,000 in the utility's safety shutoff 8 months earlier. Schultz was already reducing her supplies when she was told by Xcel Energy her town of 230 in western Boulder County would not be in the shutoff area, and so she stocked up as usual. Still, when the 112-mile-per-hour gusts of wind came December 18th, Schultz found herself in the dark with a $12,000 loss. Quote, 5 days of loss of business with no communication from Xcel as to when it would be restored, end quote, Schultz told a Colorado Public Utilities Commission hearing Wednesday evening. Quote, I know this might seem like a small number, but it's definitely enough to potentially close my business and lose employment for my employees, end quote. The commission heard from about 24 residents, business representatives, and public officials, and it received 4,000 written comments about the impacts of December's shutdown that left more than 100,000 homes and businesses without electricity. The testimony is part of the commission's information gathering to write new rules for so-called public safety power shutoffs, called PSPS. Quote, these are really challenging issues, and these comments are enormously helpful and critical, end quote, Eric Blanc, the PUC chairman, said. Three major themes emerged from the testimony: a lack of adequate communication from Xcel, an unreasonable financial burden on a handful of communities, and despite an effort by the utility to identify and help households with medical needs for electricity, some needing oxygen still struggled. Quote, our primary responsibility is to protect public safety, and we believe our actions were necessary to mitigate the risk of wildfire and safeguard lives and properties, end quote, Xcel Energy said in a statement. Quote, while we stand by our decision to prioritize safety, we acknowledge there are areas for improvement, end quote. Before and during the safety shutoff, Xcel said it communicated with customers with calls, emails, text messages, social media updates, updates on its website, and news releases. The company also has a shutoff website. Still, the testimony offered to the PUC made clear that wasn't enough. It turned out that Schultz and Jamestown were not in the blackout areas, according to Xcel Energy, and went dark due to weather damage, but Schultz did not know that or when repairs would be made. Chris Meschuk, Boulder deputy city manager, said the utility's communications, quote, were confusing, conflicting, inaccurate, and incomplete, end quote. Xcel Energy told the city that as many as 500,000 customers could be impacted, but it was less than 24 hours before the shutoff that the city learned just 4 feeder lines would be affected. Quote, I believe that they knew they were never going to shut off power to 500,000 customers, but they left us scrambling until the last minute and until at our request we had a meeting where they said, quote, oh no, there'll only be 4 feeders, end quote, Meschuk said. Quote, we know being without power is disruptive and can be frustrating, so we take the decisions to implement a PSPS very seriously, end quote, Xcel Energy said. What is it? Was it a shutoff or did a tree fall in the forest? In the tiny western Boulder County community of Ward, population 127, people were getting conflicting information about why they didn't have power, according to town resident Clyde Placencia. Quote, we spoke to Xcel throughout the day. We didn't have power. They told us multiple conflicting stories, end quote, Placencia said. Quote, we had multiple Xcel managers tell us that we were part of the PSPS, that we weren't part of the PSPS, or that a tree had fallen down on the lines, end quote. Quote, so it's pretty clear to us that experience that there isn't even an inter-organization sharing of information, end quote, Placencia said. Quote, none of them seem to know what is going on in our area at any given time, end quote. Schultz's was far from the only business that suffered losses. A survey of 100 businesses in Golden by the Golden Chamber of Commerce tallied nearly $2 million in losses. Quote, we know that only accounts for a small portion of the business community, end quote, Nola Krajewski, the chamber's president and CEO, told the PUC. The shutoff was for safety reasons, so those losses aren't reimbursed by Xcel Energy, and since it was not caused by weather or property damages, businesses can't file an insurance claim. Quote, I feel like a pawn in the game of liability between a billion-dollar energy giant and insurance companies that also report billions of dollars of profit, end quote, said Brandon Bortles, who owns 2 Golden restaurants, Nosu Ramen and Abejas Bistro. Quote, I think a lot of people that suffered through this are looking for some recourse so we can come up with some designation that a PSPS is an emergency weather event that is worked through the Division of Insurance, end quote, Bortles said. The Boulder Chamber surveyed 300 local employers, with 86% reporting a business interruption with the average financial loss of $25,000 and a total of 2,000 workers, 20,000 workers affected. 9 businesses had losses of more than $100,000. Quote, what we all recognize, whether planned or unplanned power outages of this nature,